You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk with a former U.S. senator about how a haunting image influenced his work in Congress and beyond. Now, socialism is part of our political conversations today, with lots of debating over what it really means and how it might work in practice. A new PBS documentary is adding to the conversation by looking back at Milwaukee's history. From 1910 to 1960, the city elected three socialist mayors and the country's first socialist congressman. With a combined 38 years in office, the city's socialist mayors played a big role in shaping modern Milwaukee. Lynn Sprangers is an award-winning journalist who previously served as chief political reporter for WTMJ Television in Milwaukee. She's one of the producers of America's Socialist Experiment that airs at 9 tonight on PBS Wisconsin and at 8 tomorrow on Milwaukee Public Television. Lynn, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. My pleasure.
Why did you want to tell this story of Milwaukee's socialist history in 2020?
Well, one of the facets we've always heard about good filmmaking is to find an interesting story. And the more we looked at this period of time, which really ran, as you said, 38 years, but it was spread over 50. So for the first half of the 20th century, socialists were guiding and leading and governing in Milwaukee. And the more we talked with people, even people who grew up in Milwaukee and people who we think are curious and they read and they're politically connected, didn't know that much about this particular period of time. And so the more that we visited with people and chatted and said, is this something that you think would make a good story? People said yes. And the donors for the film agreed. So we really started with that premise that it was an underreported story and one that should be told.
It's a Milwaukee story, and you focus a lot on Milwaukee and Wisconsin voices talking about the story. Can you give us a sense of who we're going to hear from?
Sure. Well, you know, there's, as you said, this is a great debate right now as we're in the midst of an election year and a pandemic, a recession, and obviously social justice protests. So there is a lot out there that's going to factor into our political conversation. So this story could have been told through a lot of different voices. But because it has a distinctly Milwaukee and Wisconsin connection, we decided to stay with local storytellers, people who had who've been in Milwaukee, who sort of know what's in our DNA and what from that socialist period of time carried over into the, you know, into this next century. So we talked with the daughter of Mayor Frank Seidler. He was the third and last socialist mayor, at least during that era. And we talked with Dan Steininger, who's the grandson of Dan Hone. He was the second socialist mayor. And former Mayor John Norquist, Margot Anderson, and John Gerda, historians who have written books about this period of time. John Nichols, known to many folks in Madison and across the state for his work at the Capital Times, The Nation, and also the author of a book on socialism. We interviewed local elected officials. We talked with Bud Selig. He makes an appearance in the film. I'll just tease it by saying there's a connection between the Green Bay Packers and this film that you'll just have to tune in and watch.
Now, socialism means different things to a lot of different people, even among socialists. In the Milwaukee context, what did the socialists mean by that?
Well, they were swept into power in 1910 for really two major reasons. Milwaukee was an incredibly corrupt city in terms of its government, and it was also a very dirty, a physically dirty city. We were an industrial city. This is before we had laws and clean water acts and things that really cleaned up that front in a lot of urban areas. The socialists ran on a promise to fix both. They would fix government, they would make government cleaner, and they would also make the city's living conditions cleaner. They promised a better life for working people. And one of the things that really struck us as we did the research on this film is they had a propensity to listen to regular folks. They listened. And in doing so, they pushed for better working conditions, an 8-hour work week, having more green space and a growth of a county park system, things that they said regular folks would be able to support and enjoy.
Talking to Lynn Spranger, she's one of the producers of the new documentary America's Socialist Experiment about socialism in Milwaukee in the 20th century. Premieres tonight at 9 on PBS Wisconsin and tomorrow at 8 p.m. on Milwaukee Public Television. We often hear the phrase thrown around sewer socialism about Milwaukee at that time. Where did that particular phrase come from?
Well, it was meant as a derision. It was a put down that national and especially East Coast socialists put down the Milwaukee socialists because they said they were too consumed with improving sanitation than having an overthrow of the capitalist system. So they refer to them as sewer socialists, and it's sort of funny because Milwaukee socialists said, "We'll take that title. We know how to win elections. And you guys on the East Coast couldn't be elected dog catcher." And so they realized early on in their tenure that if they wanted to govern, they had to win elections. And winning elections meant that they had to work within a capitalist system. There were definite speed bumps along the way, but that's how they managed to get in power, is they were smart, tactical politicians.
I'm going to fast forward past a lot of the stories you tell and look toward the end of this period in 1960. What led to the decline of socialists being able to win elections in Milwaukee?
You know, they were so successful and they had a long run. And sometimes in politics, Rob, a long run means mundane or, yeah, we've been there, done that. And a fresh voice comes along or a fresh political dynamic comes along. The socialists had such a great accomplishments during so much of their run, but they fell short on a couple of fronts, and it is why they failed in the long end, because they are not in power and they don't really have a presence of power today. There may be people who call themselves socialists, but we don't have the sort of movement that you saw back then. They failed to really build a pipeline of young talent. Political movements need people to run for office at the school board and in all of these local offices in order to then move up into the pipeline. And they just did not build a new generation of socialist leaders. Also, they were not able to make the connection during the 50s when Milwaukee was changing. The face of Milwaukee was literally changing. We had a large movement of African Americans from the South to the North, and the city was growing very extensively. The socialists did not connect with this new and growing part of Milwaukee that might have produced some of this younger talent. And after 1956, when Frank Zeidler ran for the last time, Henry Meyer stepped in 1960 and ran for mayor as a Democrat.
In our last minute or so, Lynn, what are you hoping people take away from this in the Milwaukee area and as this airs then around the country?
Yes, and we're going to be moving out to Los Angeles on Friday and other cities, and we're excited about the fact that we can bring this story to an audience nationally. One of the things that we think surprised us and we think may surprise viewers as well is how things that don't look right actually still worked out in this socialist era. And let me explain that. At the same time that Wisconsin was home to one of the country's most prominent anti-communists in the 1950s, Senator Joe McCarthy. And it was also the country's most prominent socialist who was running Milwaukee. These two guys were in the same state. They did not go after each other. Zeidler was elected at the same time that McCarthy was on his anti-communist crusade. And you look at some of these things, and it's like dogs and cats living together. It doesn't seem like it would work, but it did. And these two guys coexisted. It was one of the things that we were curious about in the film. I think people will find out new things about Milwaukee that they didn't know we did. And hopefully it will enlighten people about a period of our history here in Wisconsin that should be a story that should be told.
Lynn, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Our appreciation. Thanks for the time, Rob. We appreciate it.
That's Lynn Spranger, a journalist and one of the producers of the new documentary, America's Socialist Experiment, about Milwaukee. It premieres tonight at 9 o'clock on PBS Wisconsin and tomorrow at 8 p.m. on Milwaukee Public Television. Coming up, a Viking and a troll walk into a Wisconsin town. We'll talk to a graphic artist about a new comic book series that takes place in Stoughton. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a graphic artist about a new comic book that follows a Viking and troll superhero duo as they protect not Gotham City, but Stoughton. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with voices from this week's protests.
Demonstrations supporting Black lives and calling for police accountability have taken place in dozens of Wisconsin communities over the last week. While there have been some looting and clashes with police, the protests have been mostly peaceful. That was the case Tuesday evening in Madison when I talked with some of the people at the Capitol about why they were there.
I came out here because I've been seeing the protests on the news. And when I seen that horrific video of George Floyd, it just really hurt my heart. I just couldn't take it anymore. I have to support people. And so that's why I decided to come out here today. Oh, my name is Tatum Lockhart. I currently live in St. Perry, Wisconsin. I've been in Wisconsin for a long time. I've been here since I was 13. Now I'm almost 30. You know, and I've been through a lot in Wisconsin. I've been through a lot of different situations where I was put, you know, even as a child, put in a predicament that I was made to feel bad because of my skin color. That's why I couldn't just sit down anymore.
No justice, no peace.
No justice, no peace. Tanisha Jackson, Madison, Wisconsin. I'm here because I'm representing my people. You know, I'm representing Black Lives. I'm representing George Floyd, Tony Robinson, even Kanika Jenkins. I'm representing the people who wasn't able to stand up and speak for themselves.
My name is Jasmine Brown. This week, we've protested and we've donated water. And when I say we, I just mean me and my daughter. She's three. I just want her to be a part of this. And I want to make sure that she understands that we're not here for any reason other than equality.
Ebony Anderson Carter, and I was born at Meritor Hospital, so I'm from here. You know, I'm the only person out here that's actually listening to these kids and letting them do their thing, but also enforcing peace as well. I've pretty much become a mother to all of these kids. We just want people to come out here and fellowship, get to know these kids, come talk to these kids, ask them what their needs are, ask them what their wants are, ask them what you can do for them. This is a crisis. There should be therapists out here holding these kids' hands. I don't care about COVID. Wear a mask. But these kids are asking for help. They want a better community center. They want things to do on Fridays and Saturday nights. You know, they're kids.
I'm hoping for a better future for my daughter. I'm hoping there will be a day that problems like this don't even matter anymore, so it's not even a thought for her. She will experience racism. And if things don't change, it's a very sad future for my child.
My daughter, she's five. I want her to know that it's okay at any time, any moment to stand up for yourself. Stand up for your people. No matter how old you is, no matter how young you are, just stand up. If it's just you or if it's 1,000 people, just let your voice be heard.
I just wish that more people would support, you know, better resources, having more training for police officers. I feel like that's big.
I'm 27. My uncle is a Chicago police my entire life. I have a sister that lives in Memphis. She just became police 2 years ago. We just need to get it right. It's not about actually the badge. It's about the person behind the badge.
No justice, no peace. Police.
I've learned that I have more power than I present to people. I have a lot of more common sense than I actually thought. I also learned that in some way, shape, or form, I need to be in social services or law.
I have a dream. You know, MLK will be proud of us. You know, he'll be real proud of us right now. Starting the fresh movement, you know.
Those were voices of some of the demonstrators supporting Black Lives and Justice this week in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now there's a new superhero team on the scene, and they're protecting their city and citizens from evildoers. Vidar is a Viking, and Hans is a troll, and they work together to protect Stoughton, Wisconsin. Our next guest is one of the brains behind the series and joins us now to talk about the project. Nathan Peterson is a graphic artist and co-creator of Vidar and Hans with Gary Nauman. Nathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, tell us first about your two lead characters, Vidar and Hans.
Sure, yeah. In many ways, they're kind of polar opposites. Vidar is this kind of older, grouchy, grumpy gentleman, but he's really good with technology. And he's basically just trying to get by, you know, keep a low profile. And his friend, Hans, is a little troll, not the big grouchy troll with the big stick or anything. But his goal in life is just to kind of irritate Vidar, you know, when it's all in good fun. But yeah, that's kind of his main goal in life. So it's fun seeing those two interact quite a bit. So.
And what was the inspiration behind doing this comic?
Yeah. So one day I walked up to a friend at work, and I knew he was an artist, and I used to draw a lot, but I just kind of gave it up. I didn't know what to do with it. And so one day after praying, I walked up to my friend Gary and said, "Hey, Gary, I know you draw a lot. Like, do you ever think about doing something on the side outside of work?" And he's like, "Yeah, actually, I have this idea for this Viking who lives in Stoughton, Wisconsin." And I was like, "What? Like, tell me more." And so basically it just, the world just kind of unfolded from his mind. And it's just like, I want to do that. Like, when do we start? So that's kind of how it came about.
And what was behind the interest in doing this? You know, we see a lot of superheroes in either, you know, New York or Gotham City, mm-hmm. or Metropolis, which are basically just, you know, New York. Why Stoughton in particular?
Yeah. So Gary lives right near Stoughton, and he's always had a passion for the small town. And I used to be a teacher in a couple different small town schools too. So I also have a passion for small towns, and just, there's a certain charm about it. And we kind of want to highlight, you know, that sometimes these towns are overlooked, but we really appreciate it. Things in Stoughton that really stand out are the Norwegian Heritage, the Set to Maya Festival that was canceled, things like that. And, you know, I'm an out-of-towner, but just getting to explore it a little bit, I'm like, we were just taking pictures of all the town, the city, and we're like, yeah, we could have a scene here, and like, we could put a monster on top of the building here. And it was just fun. It's just something new and different.
Yeah. Speaking of monsters, what kind of villains, or maybe misunderstood monsters, I don't know, and other challenges are Vidar and Hans going to face?
Sure. So at the end of our first issue, you get a taste of one of the first villains, although it's, yeah, more of a misunderstood monster, like you said, and it's Bunzilla. So it's a giant rabbit that was basically enlarged thanks to Hans's like antics. And so, you know, it's a 30, 40, 50 foot tall rabbit in the middle of downtown Stoughton. So that's kind of one of the things they have to face. But we look forward to kind of delving in future issues into Norse mythology a little bit more. Classic superhero villains, like, you know, not copying them, but like kind of inspired by that, stuff like that. So it should be good variety.
And you mentioned Set to Maya, a famous Stoughton festival, and it didn't happen this year, but you did a special edition of Vidar and Hans. How did they deal with a socially isolated Set to Maya?
Yeah. So the original plan was we were going to be at Set to Maya and start selling issues. That was going to kind of be our debut. And once again, being out of towner, I had never been to one before, so I was really looking forward to it. Gary kept telling me stories about, oh, they have rose mauling and they have canoe races. I'm like, this sounds awesome. Like, even if I wasn't selling a comic, I'd want to go and just check it out. So, and then COVID hit and, you know, it got canceled. And so I have this idea, like, what if we did like a quarantine version of it, you know, of our comic? And Gary's like, yeah, let's do it. So basically we just took some full size images, things like you can pick up your cheese curds, things like that, and you can do canoe races in your bathtub, or I know there's a 20-mile run or something that was supposed to happen that didn't, so you can jog in place for 6 hours in your kitchen if you really want to. So we just tried to acknowledge that, hey, this is sad, but at the same time we can still move forward and try to do the best we can in honoring Set to Maya, and just celebrating something in the middle of some hard times.
Now, what's your at least opening goal for the series? How long a run are you aiming for?
Yeah, that's a great question. So far, we have at least 8 issues planned, and we are working on the script for issue 2. So, yeah, we have tons of ideas. And every time Gary and I get together, we just kind of collaborate and bounce ideas off of each other. And it's been really fun. So we always have more ideas for more things to try. So I'm looking forward to see what happens.
Well, if I can ask a personal question, do you personally identify more with Vidar, the strong and silent Viking, or Hans, the bumbling troll?
I think I would identify more with Vidar because I'm Scandinavian and he's Scandinavian. Sometimes I can be more quiet. I definitely wouldn't say I'm strong and silent, just kind of tall and gawky and silent. And I usually don't push people's buttons, but I have a few friends who kind of inspire me.
Yeah, I'm probably more on the Han side of things. Nathan, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That's Nathan Peterson, a graphic artist and co-creator of Vidar and Hans with Gary Nauman. He joined us today to talk about their new comic book series that follows the superhero Viking and troll duo as they protect Stoughton. Coming up, we'll talk about some significant historic challenges facing today's Native American youth and also some ways they're getting help. Former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan joins the show to talk about a photograph that changed his political career. His book was called The Girl in the Photograph, the true story of a Native American child lost and found in America. We'll hear from Senator Dorgan and the director of a group that works with Native American youth around the nation. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, a lot of the internet activity surrounding COVID-19 is driven by bots, not by actual people. Meet a researcher who's tracking down the fake people online, the messages they're sending, and what might be driving the agenda of the people who created them. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. First, for the next half hour, we're going to be talking about challenges facing Native American youth and work that's being done to help them out. A note to listeners before we start, the discussion could include mentions and descriptions of some heavy topics, including child abuse, sexual assault, and youth suicide. A single photograph in the newspaper changed the course of one, if not many, lives. Byron Dorgan was reading that newspaper and saw a young Native American girl with a tear on her cheek. The photo accompanied a story about how she'd been beaten in several different housing situations. She became the face of a problem, a failure of social services on her reservation. Byron Dorgan is a former U.S. senator and congressman who represented North Dakota. His book about what happened after he saw this newspaper is called The Girl in the Photograph, the true story of a Native American child lost and found in America. Senator Dorgan, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. Good afternoon to you.
And also with us is Nikki Petrie, acting executive director of the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute based in Washington, D.C. Senator Dorgan founded the organization after deciding not to seek re-election. Nikki, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Dorgan, let's start with you. You tell the story of the girl in the photograph in great detail in the story. I wonder if you could highlight two moments for us, Senator Dorgan, when you saw her photo and then when she reached out to you on social media years later.
Yeah, well, I mean, I saw the photograph. It was a Sunday newspaper, top of the fold, color photograph of this beautiful young girl who had been beaten severely in a foster home on an Indian reservation. Her arm, her leg, her nose were broken, hair pulled out at the roots, and then she laid in an empty room for a couple of days with no medical attention. Think of that, at age 2. And a couple of years later, they did a story about abuse of children on these foster homes and reservations, and that was her picture that I saw. And I went to meet her and her grandfather on that Indian reservation. She didn't seem like she knew I was there. She was pretty significantly altered and injured as a result of what had happened to her a couple years before. But at any rate, just to tell you, I then lost track of her. I sent her a couple Christmas gifts to her grandfather, and her grandfather died. I would ask people on that reservation, would ever happen to that little girl? And no one knew. No one had ever heard of her again. And so that was it. But I kept that photograph in my mind. I had that copy of the newspaper in my desk drawer for many, many years. 27 years later, I got an email from her, and it turns out she was homeless. She had been through hell. I mean, she had just been through so many problems. Homeless in Minneapolis, and she went to a library to use a computer to try to figure out what had happened to her because she had very little memory of her youth. And lo and behold, in her search using the computer at a library, she found a speech that I had given about her in the United States Senate. And I used her name. I told the story of her beating, and I did it in the context of what was happening to Native American youth. And as a result, she reached out to me and sent me an email. And that email, of course, created a whole series of events that I got involved in since. And so that's the story of how I learned about her and how we reconnected.
We'll hear more of that story. Nikki, I want to bring you into the picture now. You are directing the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. And something that strikes me looking at the efforts there, Nikki, is this isn't just about providing help to Native American youth. This is about helping Native American youth themselves take the lead in solving problems. Can you talk about the importance of that?
Absolutely. Young Indigenous professional trying to navigate, this is something that I have grown up knowing my entire life, that we need to better our communities. Everything that we do is for the next generation. And so being able to have the opportunity to work at the Center for Native American Youth, which we are so grateful. I remember being a young professional and hearing about CNAY's creation and everything that Senator Dorgan had done for Indian Country prior, and being able to make sure that Native youth are at the forefront of policy change, of driving positive change in their community, not just saying that we need to be improving lives, but allowing Native youth and giving them the tools that they need to create that positive change is so inspiring. And so just so much gratitude for Senator Dorgan and also for the organization for allowing youth leaders to lead in this space. It's very much needed.
And Senator Dorgan, in the book, The Girl in the Photograph, you spend a lot of time talking about the challenges and problems facing Native Americans and Native American youth, and we'll get into that some. But you really are careful to say it's not just doom and gloom. Can you highlight some of the bright spots that you share in the book?
No, listen, I've written a book that's pretty heavy and, you know, about a young woman that's been through a lot. She's better now, but I wanted to shine all the spotlights on the same spot, the plight of Native American youth. And that's why I created the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. And from that center, we do something called Champions for Change that Nikki's involved with me in. And we find some unbelievably inspiring young Native Americans across the country. And they are our champions for change. They are mentors for other young people. They do unbelievable things. I've written a lot about them in the book. And, it's important for people to know there's a lot left to do, but we do have some people out there, some young people on Indian reservations that are doing extraordinary things. This is an important time, and I would say, you know, there are two great stains on the American conscience, in my judgment. One is slavery, and the second is the way the first Americans, Native Americans, have been treated for over a couple centuries. They were the last people to get the right to vote. They've lived in great poverty, and they just have not been full participants in what America has become. And I think that needs to change.
Talking to Senator Byron Dorgan, a former senator from North Dakota. His new book is called The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. Also with us, Nikki Petrie, acting executive director of the Center for Native American Youth at the Aspen Institute. Senator Dorgan had founded that organization. Senator Dorgan, before we get back to Nikki to talk some more about the solutions they're working on there, Can you lay out some of the problems that Tamara, the girl in the photograph herself, her life was just a microcosm of all these challenges mm-hmm. facing, that there are common stories, sadly, for Native Americans on the country. Can you tell us some of what she encountered that she's just one of many examples of, sadly?
I will do that. But first, let me tell you, a man named Joseph Marshall, a historian, Lakota historian, was speaking in Colorado at a conference. And someone in the audience stood up and said to him, well, wait a second. And he was waving his arms. Wait a second. Wasn't this dispute with respect to Native Americans, wasn't this dispute between your ancestors and my ancestors? Why am I held accountable? Why should I be held accountable? And Joseph Marshall said to the men, because you know the story. Because you know the story. And when you know the story of an injustice, you have a responsibility to help change it. So that is such an important concept. Tamara is a young woman who has, you know, all the things that have visited her in a horrific way, the beating, the abuse. It deals with the substance abuse of her parents and abuse she suffered at the hands of many. She's been sexually abused. She has attempted to commit suicide several times. She's had great difficulty in education, and yet she's a very bright woman. She's turned 35. She's in a better place, and I've spent a great deal of time with her and helping her. But, a couple people that she never knew, strangers in her life, I think saved her life in many ways, and I can tell you those stories. But it's a circumstance where I wanted to use her story and the difficulties she has experienced, and she was happy to do that. She said, if telling my story helps other Native American children, I'm really, really happy that we can do that together. So that's what I've done. And her story is a microcosm of almost all the things that have been wrong and the things that need to be made right. And I think we can do it.
Nikki, can you talk about some things that you and the champions that Senator Dorgan mentioned that you work with at the Center for Native American Youth have done to tackle some of these problems that Senator Dorgan just laid out?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sorry, I just get kind of emotional when I think about this, because these are our own people. And something that we do with the Champions for Change is we have what's called Champions Week, where we bring them out to Washington, D.C. We celebrate their accomplishments. We celebrate the positive change you're trying to make. And we do very targeted curriculum training. We teach them about Advocacy 101, how to utilize social media as a platform. We teach them about the power in sharing your personal story. We bring them to Capitol Hill to meet with their senators. And we have a public event where we have Native youth, the Champions for Change, sharing the work that they're doing. And then we also have a set reception that kind of celebrates their work and that celebrates the work of the Center for Native American Youth. And so we don't stop there just after Champions for Change Week. We're on the road with them throughout the entire year. We're providing technical assistance to them, connecting them to like-minded organizations to help elevate their work. And then they join our youth advisory board, which very much governs a lot of our programmatic work, along with Senator Dorgan and the board of advisors. And so the Champions for Change Week is just the beginning of a way that we stay engaged with these youth leaders and highlight the powerful work that they're doing to truly transform not just their communities, but society at large.
We're talking to former U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan. Also with us is Nikki Petrie, acting executive director of the Center for Native American Youth. We're talking about Senator Dorgan's book. It's called The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. We want to hear from you. Do you have thoughts about the challenges Native American youth are facing today, both on and off reservations? Do you have any experience yourself as part of that community or working with the community? If you're a Native American with a story to share about your childhood, your adolescence, tweet us at Central Time WPR. That's Central Time WPR, and let us know. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with former U.S. Senator from North Dakota, Byron Dorgan, and Nikki Petrie, acting executive director of the Center for Native American Youth. We're talking about Senator Dorgan's book. It's called The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. You can share your thoughts. What thoughts do you have about the federal government's treatment of Native Americans? Is this part of your own life's story? Are you involved with efforts to repair some of the damage our guests are talking about? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Senator Dorgan, in the book, you talk about problems like underfunded healthcare systems for Native Americans, underfunded educational systems. Now, inspired by Tamara and others, when you took these issues to the Senate floor, did your colleagues listen?
Well, not all of them listened, for sure. I mean, much of what exists there, particularly with respect to Indian health, is dramatically underfunded. It's estimated that only about 50% of the funds that are needed to provide for health care for Native Americans, only about 50% is available. You know, the federal government has promised Native Americans they would provide for their health care. That's in treaties, it's in writing, it's a promise that was made. And a long, long time ago, but it's a promise never kept. And we also have a responsibility to provide health care for federal prisoners. We run the federal prison and the federal government. But, you know, you spend almost twice as much on health care for federal prisoners per person as they do for Native Americans. I mean, that's just shameful. But I did want to say to you that a couple of the things that we work on, especially at the Center for Native American Youth, is teen suicide prevention on Indian reservations. There's too much teen suicide clusters that are very serious, and we're trying really hard to address this issue of teen suicide prevention. And then in addition, education opportunity and youth engagement. Those are the things that we spend a lot of time working on at the Center for Native American Youth.
And Nikki, Senator Dorgan talks in his book about the concept of historical trauma as a cause for loss of connection to culture and tradition in Native communities. Can you talk about that as part of the solution, reconnecting with those, I won't just say cultures and traditions?
Yeah. So the term that I like to use is historical resiliency. Mm. Despite the fact that, you know, how we had been discussing Natives were the last to vote, geographic isolation on many reservations, boarding schools, the list kind of goes on. Despite all of that, we are still here. We come from a warrior people. And so being able to instill that pride and instill that resiliency in our youth leaders is a cultural teaching. And so our youth leaders get it and they understand it. And so we're able to apply that into our programming, that because of this, because we are resilient, we are able to make positive change that we need in our communities, such as teen suicide prevention, such as access to education for our people. So I think if we focus more on the resiliency and the power that youth leaders have to make this change, that's going to carry us through.
Let me just tell you a story I told in the book. I've told a good many stories in the book that are inspiring, but let me tell you a story about Dakota Brown, a young man who became our champion for change among a number of champions for change that we've selected. He was in school, in high school in California, saw his friends failing in class, going to be kicked off the football team and so on. And so he said to his best friend, who was a football star, who's going to lose his ability to play and get kicked out of school, he said, "You're as smart as I am, but he said, let me suggest something to you. I'll spend an hour a day, every day after school, to help you catch up and keep up with your studies. You know, you need to do this." And so they started an organization called NERDS, NERDS, Native Education Raising Dedicated Students. And all of a sudden it became kind of cool, and others started. And kids that were, you know, these Native American kids who were getting C's and D's and F's began getting, you know, B's and A minus and C's. And the girl that was the youngest girl in that group, NERDS, she joined when she was in eighth grade because she was a slow learner. But she thought it was pretty neat, so she joined NERDS. Well, guess what? She just graduated from high school a couple of years ago with a 4.0 grade point average. So Dakota Brown started that. He took it to three other schools. This young guy, by the way, is now at Stanford. You know, it is such a great story, and there are a good many of those stories in this book as well that can describe great successes, even as I talk about the difficulty that Tamara has had and the life that she has had.
Talking to Senator Byron Dorgan, former senator from North Dakota, and Nikki Petrie, looking at Senator Dorgan's book, The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. Let's bring on a caller now. Tim is with us in Northeast Wisconsin. Tim, hello.
Hi. I'm not sure if you guys touched on this earlier. I had to step away from the radio for a bit. But I just wanted to comment on ICWA and some of the challenges that the Indian Child Welfare Act actually places on the system and in the challenge. We're a pre-adoptive ICWA-approved home, and we're fostering a three-year-old youth with the goal of adoption, and it's been nothing but frustrating, and just a tragic story all the way around for the family, for the child, and he's in a good spot now, and the mother pops back into the picture, and she's doing, you know, fairly good, but ICWA requires so much active effort to put that child back in that bad situation that it's just ridiculous. It's to the point where the mother was sentenced to probation, and 2 weeks later, you know, there she is, you know, in a place that she's not supposed to be with.
Tim, thank you for sharing that story. Senator Dorgan, I heard you kind of nodding along there. Can you talk about challenges in that foster care system?
I can, but I know both sides of the ICWA debate. Sure. I really do. And I say to that gentleman, God bless you for wanting to love a young child and adopt a child. There has been a time that created ICWA as a result of a lot of children being taken away from parents and taken away from their culture and moved hundreds of miles and thousands of miles away and prevented from being a part of that culture. ICWA was created, and I understand that it has made it more difficult for some in some cases, but ultimately it will work if he's patient and it's the right thing. I think the process will work for him. But we also want to make certain that those young children that are taken away, and Tamara, by the way, was taken from her abusive alcoholic parents, that's not where you want a child to be. But when you do take someone away from that circumstance, we also want them to be able to be a part of and understand their culture going forward as well. So that's I understand both sides of that ICWA debate, but when it was enacted by a senator from South Dakota, Senator Ebrusk, it was really needed back then, and I think is still needed, but it has made sometimes things a bit more difficult, but has also improved things as well.
Thanks for the call, Tim. We just have a few minutes left. Nikki, briefly, if there's a young Native American person listening right now, maybe seeing whatever the challenges in their local community, how would you encourage them to become active and take on a leadership role themselves?
I think the first thing I would tell them is that they are already a leader. Just by being present and whatever they're going through, that they deserve to be empowered, supported, and loved, and that they have everything that it takes. So find that fire that they have within them and go out and make the positive change and turn to resources like the Center for Native American Youth to be an ally and to help support and promote their work, and that they are very much loved and respected and are leaders.
And Senator Dorgan, in our last minute and a half, you've been working on these issues for a long time. Some dark stories out there, but do you feel optimistic looking back at the last couple decades?
I do. It's been a tough couple centuries, as a matter of fact, for Native Americans. But there's a lot of inspiring things happening, and I think things can and will improve. I've written a number of other books, a couple of about economics and a couple novels and so on. This was a hard book to write, but one that I absolutely felt needed to be written, and it was published by St. Martin's Press in New York. And I hope people take a look at it and understand, you know, when you see an injustice and know of an injustice, when you know the story, all of us have a responsibility to address it.
Senator Dorgan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Nikki, thanks to you for being with us.
Thank you much. Thank you. Bye.
That's Byron Dorgan, former U.S. Senator from North Dakota, and Nikki Petrie, Acting Executive Director of the Center for Native American Youth. We talked to them about Senator Dorgan's book called The Girl in the Photograph, The True Story of a Native American Child Lost and Found in America. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get the latest on COVID-19, what we know, how to plan around it in our daily lives, and what experts are watching for in the months to come. Plus, we'll hear from Wisconsin's health secretary later in the week about the latest numbers in the state. And don't look now, but there's a black hole closer to us than we thought. Don't worry, it's still a long way away. We'll check out that discovery and some other big news from space. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, more and more produce is coming from Wisconsin farms this time of year. Keeley talks to Inga Witcher from the PBS Wisconsin show Around the Farm Table. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it turns out people have been cutting and pasting things into scrapbooks longer than I would have thought, even since the early 1800s. We'll talk about the stories that a scrapbook can tell. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.